Public Affairs for Tuesday, January 27th, 2009. Welcome. I'd like to start with the usual reminder that in these rooms, any type of electronic device like a cell phone, BlackBerry, PDA, if left on, will interfere with our sound equipment. So as difficult as it may be, please try very hard to turn off your devices during the hearing that we're having today. I open an informational meeting today. We are going to have today an overview of foreclosure timelines and trends, and talk about the impact of foreclosure on homeowners, financial institutions, and tenants. There are several presenters today, and I would like to make sure that we are able to hear from everyone within the allotted time. It's my understanding that many of you were together yesterday on the House side. Welcome back together. I'll try very hard to make sure that we stay within our time frame today, if everyone could keep that in mind during the testimony. And I'll let you know what I have planned in terms of panels. First, we'll hear from Gary Blackledge, an attorney, about is Gary here?
Yes.
Okay, about foreclosure timelines and an overview of how foreclosure works in Oregon. And also, coming up with you, Gary, we'll have Paul Cosgrove from the Oregon Financial Services Association, because Paul needs to leave early today. Next, we'll have Pam Levitt from the Credit Union Association of Oregon and Linda Navarro from the Oregon Bankers Association after that. And joining them will be Fred, and I hope I say your name right, Postlewaite, President and CEO of Oregon Coast Bank, will be sitting with them on the panel. Following that, from the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association is Chris Ambrose and Eric Wiley from Pacific Residential Mortgage. Following those presentations, we'll hear from Angela Martin from Our Oregon and Matt Wallace from Osberg. And finally, Phil Goldsmith and Sybil Hebb. Phil is an attorney in private practice in Portland, and Sybil Hebb is from the Oregon Law Center. So that's the order I have planned, so everybody knows ahead of time. I would like, if the committee members would wait to hold your questions till the end of each panel. I think we'll be able to get more accomplished if we're able to do that. If it's something very pressing, please feel free to let me know. Okay, Gary and Gary Blackledge and Paul Cosgrove. Thank you. Welcome. And if you will please introduce yourselves and say your name for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary Blackledge, attorney practicing with Green & Markley in Portland, Oregon. Go ahead, Gary. Okay. So basically, I'm here to give you information on foreclosures in Oregon. There are essentially three kinds of mortgage security devices that are commonly used in Oregon. The most common is the trust deed, which is essentially a mortgage. The second is a mortgage. And then the third is less common, is a land sale contract. It's commonly used where sellers of property carry back the purchase price in exchange for payments for a deed. I think that at least it's my understanding that this committee is more concerned about the trust deed than it is the other two types, a mortgage or a land sale contract. The trust deed foreclosure procedure in Oregon basically goes like this. When the borrower is in default, the lender will instruct the trustee, or often appoint a successor trustee. And what's happened in Oregon is there's been a trend to using out-of-state trustee companies that do handle the foreclosures, or sometimes title companies will use these out-of-state companies as their agents to handle the non-judicial trustee foreclosures. A trust deed can either be foreclosed judicially, like a mortgage or a contract, or it can be foreclosed non-judicially under the statutory procedure set out in the Oregon Trust Deed Act. So when the lender instructs the trustee to foreclose, the first thing that the trustee should do is make sure that all the assignments of the beneficiary's interest in the trust deed, and I should say that a beneficiary in a trust deed is the lender, typically, or the lender's successor in interest. And so Oregon law requires that all those assignments be recorded before the foreclosure can commence. The trustee then commences the foreclosure by recording what's called a notice of default and election to sell. And this basically recites the fact that the identification of the trustee, the recording information, and that kind of thing. And it also recites the what the default is. And then it also states in it that the balance is accelerated. And then it also gives certain information to the borrower or the borrower's successor about the statutory right to cure by making up the mispayments, if that's what the default is, or you know if they've not provided insurance or whatever the default is, they can cure up until 5 days before the date set for the sale. So this notice of default is recorded, but as of that time, the borrower may not know that the foreclosure's been commenced. Typically what happens is the trustee will record this notice of default that sets forth the sale date in it, but the sale date will be set out quite a ways because the statute requires that a trustee's notice of sale be sent to the borrower at least 120 days before the sale is conducted. And so because of the fact that the trustee needs to confirm the address for the borrower, if the borrower isn't in the property, and other junior lien holders that may have an interest in the property, has to compile all these addresses. Plus, the trustee has to serve occupants of the property with the trustee's notice of sale personally in the same manner as a summons and complaint and a judicial action are served. The trustee will allow typically more than 120 days to accomplish this service because sometimes I've had situations where you can't serve the occupant because they're never there and the process server can't find them and you're approaching the deadline, the 120th day before the date you've set for the sale, and so you need to make sure that that service is made. So once the service is made, then typically you go into a limbo period where nothing is happening. You wait for the borrower or somebody to contact you and find out, you know, what they're owing. I might add that as of last session, the trustees now have to send out the what we call the home loss notice that was required now by House Bill 3630 from last session. At the time, typically most of the trustees are sending that out at the time that the trustee's notice of sale is sent out. And the trustee's notice of sale and the home loss notice are mailed to the borrower, the grantor, all the other parties that, you know, a lot of trustees are just sending it to everybody, you know, regardless, so they make sure that they get it to the right person. In any event, that is mailed out, and then we wait for people to contact us, and typically nothing happens for a long period of time. And then, comes at least typically about a month and a half before the sale date, the trustee will publish the trustee's notice in the newspaper of general circulation for four successive weeks, and I believe the last publication has to be made at least 20 days before the date of the sale. And then there's also a federal tax lien check because we have to check to see if there are any federal tax liens that have been filed at least 25 days before the sale date so that we can make sure that at the end of the day, when the foreclosure is completed, clear title will be given to the purchaser. So around that time, many trustees also will send out at least between 30 days before the sale and 20 days before the sale a notice to occupants of the property. Typically, this is done regardless of whether the occupant is the grantor or not, and that's a 30-day notice basically saying that the purchaser at the sale is entitled to possession on the 10th day after the sale, and that if the occupants don't vacate, that they may be evicted. And so then when the sale is held, the trustee is obligated by the statute to deliver a trustee's deed. That's the deed conveying the title to the property to the purchaser at the sale within 10 days after the sale. And that's basically the end of the non-judicial process. There is no right of redemption for any junior lien creditor or the borrower or the borrower's successor at that time. It's essentially a done deal. Alternatively, a trust deed may be foreclosed judicially like a mortgage, and in those cases, it's a lawsuit is filed, summons is served, and the timelines are what is typical for a judicial action where that can be prevailed upon with a summary judgment motion unless there are issues as to a dispute about payment, which may spread it out longer as a legal action can be spread out. Are there any questions?
I'll start with a question. It's my understanding that most foreclosures are trustee non-judicial foreclosures.
That's correct.
That correct? And under what circumstances would a trustee be foreclosed in a judicial foreclosure?
Typically, those are for non-residential trust deeds, and I should say that the Oregon Trust Deed Act defines a residential trust deed as one in which it's a 1 to 4 residential units that the grantor, the grantor's spouse, or dependent child occupies as their principal residence when the foreclosure is commenced. So they may have occupied it years ago and moved out. It's no longer a residential trust deed unless they're occupying it when the foreclosure is commenced. In those cases, a deficiency judgment can be obtained if the proceeds at the sheriff's sale don't satisfy the debt.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Girard or Vice Chair George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, in normal situations, if the sale does not recoup back the entire amount that's being borrowed in a residential loan, is there a liability to the original borrower at that time for that deficiency?
No. On a residential trust deed, there's no further action that can be made on the debt after a non-judicial foreclosure of a residential trust deed. That's the remedy that they get is recovery of the property and no further action on the debt.
And then follow up real quick, but on some commercial, and then you can come back and get additional liability from the borrower.
That's correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Cosgrove, and I represent the Oregon Financial Services Association. I'm one of the first of a couple of lender or organizations that will be providing some information for you today. And just briefly, Oregon Financial Services Association is a group of lenders who have been making subprime loans to folks before the term subprime even existed. Some of my members date back to the 30s and are local companies. Some of my members are the consumer finance subsidiaries of national banks with names like Wells Fargo and City Financial and HSBC. My job for you today is just to cover a couple of issues, and then, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions. One is to talk about the flurry of activities that have affected lenders in general, my members and others, at the federal level, and to bring you up to speed at least briefly on those kinds of matters, and then to talk just ever so briefly on some of the voluntary efforts that lenders across the country are doing in order to mitigate the effects of foreclosure during these trying economic times. all of you have been serving in this legislature for a number of years, and you have been fully aware, because you've lived through it, as we have the flurry of activity at the state level in Salem dealing with mortgages and lending activities. Lots of bills, lots of discussions, lots of debates, work groups, endless meetings, and the good chair and I have spent a lot of time in various buildings and work group meetings on this topic, as have many others. At the same time, although we all, I think, are aware of what we hear about the national economy and what the Federal Reserve is doing in terms of trying to prop up the national economy, there's been a flurry of regulatory activity affecting financial institutions at the national level. Linda Navarro, who you'll hear from in a few minutes, was kind enough to give me a printout from her organization, her national organization, American Bankers, that lists the 50 separate federal regulatory actions, meaning rulemakings, that were pending at some time during 2008 affecting banks and, in many cases, most of the other lenders that you'll be hearing from today. Some of those rulemakings were specific to banks, and then there were other rulemakings by other federal regulatory agencies that were specific to other types of lenders. Some of those rulemakings were broadly effective to everyone, and those include major changes in the federal truth in lending regulations, which I think some of you have heard about in the past, which did made dramatic changes in terms of the kinds of loans that any of us could offer and the terms and provisions of those loans and what we need to do in order to be able to make loans for different kinds of borrowers, as well as lots of changes in the disclosures that we all have to make in loans. My members are generally state-regulated entities, so they are the kind of people who could be affected by bills you pass here. But one of my members, Wells Fargo, their state-regulated entity, has just turned back its licenses and decided to go under the authority of the Fed, of the National Bank. And one of the big issues for all of us is the impact of differing state regulations compared to the federal regulations that generally affect all of us, and the unlevel playing field that state-regulated institutions can be subjected to if we're not careful. My members have generally a choice of whether to be state-regulated and therefore subject to the things that you pass versus nationally regulated and therefore subject to the ones that affect all lenders. But I wanted you to know that there are just many, many things going on. And the reason I think that's important from your perspective is it has been a fast-moving topic, and it has been a very active topic, and many of the financial institutions who make loans to Oregonians are doing the best to keep up with all of those changes and implementing all those changes. One that I want to mention to you, which is sort of a funny hybrid between federal regulation of state institutions that you otherwise regulate here, also passed last year, affects my members and some others. Under a new federal law, all of the mortgage loan originators that work for my member companies, employees of my member companies, they're not independent contractors, now will have to be licensed under a bill that we certainly hope passes in this legislative session. And they will have to be licensed in such a way that meets the requirements of the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department. And if we don't pass a bill, or make significant progress toward passing that bill by July 1, 2009, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development will license all of those folks for us. So for obvious reasons, we are hopeful that that issue will come forward to you and be acted on in a way that we can continue to do business under state regulation. The other topic I just wanted to briefly cover is foreclosure mitigation, and there are many efforts that have been voluntarily entered into by a variety of financial institutions. I just want to mention one because it happens to be one that was announced last week. Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, which is now the owner of Washington Mutual, amongst other financial institutions, most of which carry the Chase name, but some of which do not, just announced last week on January 16th that its voluntary mortgage modification program that had been in place for a number of months has now been expanded so that it also covers those mortgages that have been sold in the secondary market and are owned in investment pools. Chase has $1.1 trillion of loans in those investment pools that are now subject to this new mortgage modification program. And I won't go into the details because it's a variety of things that are part of the program, and I'm not sure that I could tell you accurately all the aspects of it. But Chase, in making this announcement, also mentioned that since October 31st of last year, before this expansion, they have modified and prevented foreclosures on 330,000 loans. So I give that as an example of the efforts that are beyond the regulatory ones at the federal level and beyond the things that you have and may be considering in the future for regulations at the state level. There's a whole overlay of voluntary programs that are trying to address this issue as well, and that's just one and the most recent example I could find. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Anyone? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Pam Levitt and Linda Navarro, joined by Fred Postlewaite. And I hope I said that correctly. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Welcome. I'll let you decide who's going first.
Linda pointed to me.
That works.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Pam Levitt. I represent the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We have 85 credit unions in Oregon, both state and federally chartered, about 30 state charter credit unions under the Oregon Credit Union Act and under the laws and regulations of the state of Oregon. But those 30 represent about 75% of our asset base, so they're the larger. Credit unions have, I submitted some testimony to you, and I'm just going to be very brief today because I know you have a lot of panels, and a lot of the lenders have kind of the same story to tell about federal regulations. We were pleased to participate in the mortgage lending work group. There was so much good legislation referencing back to the last special session, new proposals coming out from the Department of Consumer and Business Services for this legislative session. Appreciate all of the chair's participation in all of those work group meetings. Credit unions tend to be a little bit more conservative in our lending practices, and this is why we've really largely avoided some of the mortgage meltdown that's happened in the rest of the industry. Our conservative lending practices has really helped us in protecting our members, protecting their deposits. Many of our members do have very active mortgage loan portfolios and are reporting to me that they're very strong and healthy right now. I think, like the rest of the lenders, I just want to say that we are right now going through all of the new federal regulations. Paul mentioned Truth in Lending. I gave you an example of something coming out of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It is extremely important that we help our credit unions stay up to date on all of these new regulations and make sure that they're implementing the new laws. And for us who are smaller lenders, we have all different sizes of credit unions. That's challenging and difficult at times. And so one of my jobs is to make sure that the state doesn't pass different laws and regulations implementing kind of the same issues that's going on at the federal level. We really want to make sure that our members have a clear understanding of what their direction and what they're supposed to do. On the back, on the second page, I just gave you some trends because I guess on the good news side, our members are reporting that they're seeing big increases in their mortgage lending applications, and that's primarily because of the dip in the interest rates right now, but they're hiring temporary staff, new staff, just to keep up with the mortgage applications, and that's good news. We're also certainly helping members who need to refinance and get out of other loans that they got themselves into and are working hard to provide a lot of mortgage services for those individuals. Lastly, I just wanted to say that I included some statistics on mortgage loan delinquency. Look that from 2007 to 2008 levels, very small increase, mortgage loan charge-off, and then just looking at the first mortgage real estate loans, lines of credit, there's a report from 2008 that is up over 2007 levels, so we're very excited about that. We look forward to working with this committee on this very important issue, and I'll turn it over to the bank.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici and members of the committee. I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'm joined by one of our member bank CEOs, Fred Postlewaite of Oregon Coast Bank. In just a moment, I'm going to turn the microphone over to a real-life banker who has on-the-ground experience in this area. But I wanted to mention that the Oregon Bankers Association represents 60 banks in the state of Oregon that are regulated depository institutions that have a responsibility, a fiduciary responsibility to their depositors and are highly regulated to protect those depositors at all times. Of the banks that we represent, approximately 40 are regulated by the state of Oregon in addition to the regulations that they face at the federal level, which are mirror those of any bank doing business in the United States. So, for example, in the case of Fred's bank, he's regulated by the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities and subject to state law, but he's also subject to all the federal regulations and is regulated and examined by the FDIC. I'm going to focus, and we're going to focus the conversation, our brief conversation, on these state-chartered banks because, of course, that's the banks that you have the ability to weigh in on within the Oregon legislature. Paul Cosgrove talked to you quite a bit about regulation. Pam mentioned it, so I won't belabor that point. There's certainly been an unprecedented flurry of activity, both around bank regulation and banking in general. Our members, even banks like Oregon Coast that have nothing really to do with the TARP program, have been this year having to deal with all kinds of issues that surround the Federal Reserve actions just simply because they're a bank doing business in this country. So it certainly has been unprecedented. There's a wide variety of community banks. Some aren't very engaged in mortgage lending, or if they are, they hold very few mortgage loans on their books. One of the reasons I'm glad Fred's here today is he does do a lot of mortgage lending at Oregon Coast Bank, and he can give some perspective. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Fred Postlewaite.
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici, members of the committee. Fred Postlewaite, president of Oregon Coast Bank. I probably should start by saying we're at the other end of the spectrum from the J.P. Morgans, Chases, whatever. We're $125 million in assets. And in the world of banking, that is minuscule. We're 6.5 years old. We were chartered in 2002. We have a state banking charter. We have reviews by the FDIC. They tag team and kind of leapfrog. Under law, they have to be here every 18 months. The state examiners were here the last 2 weeks of December, and we emerged from that alive and kicking, so we're happy, and we'll see the FDIC in approximately 18 months. Our $125 million in assets is we've got about $74 million in loans and $114 million in deposits. So two out of every $3 we loan out, the other one-third basically goes into investments. And that comes back into the mortgage lending, too. I'll mention that here in a minute. And so I was talking with Linda. Linda's around banks so much that she learns what we do, but this was an area that she wasn't really familiar with, so maybe other people aren't as well. We make a lot of mortgage loans. When you're in Newport, Oregon, you have a lot of resource-based industries. There's not a lot of industry, and so one of the things you end up having to embrace is mortgage lending. It's a retirement community. The last time we had an economic study done, they determined that 42% of the income was from pensions and retirement and investment type income. So we have a very large retirement community, and so a lot of times they come over without the idea of having a job. They're retired, and we like to furnish them with houses. Basically, when somebody comes in the door and sits down and they're interested in a house loan, we direct them one of two ways. We start talking to them, and either they're going to go into a secondary market loan that we will sell off, or it's going to be an in-house loan. Now, the difference between those two, the secondary market loans today are about 5%. Those loans are put into pools We sell them off to people that put them into pools. They're securitized. A lot of times they're guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And the interest rates are extremely low in comparison to what we could offer right through the front door. I say that those loan rates today are about 5%. Our cost of funds is about 3%. Our overhead is about 3%, and we like to get a 1% profit. So if that person is asking about an in-house loan, we would tell them the rate would be about 7%. We also have limitations as to how many loans we can do. Everybody, a short real estate loan is 15 years usually. They don't even make them for less than 10 on the secondary market. 30 is the most common length. We have no 30-year CDs, absolutely zero. So the money we loan out into mortgage loans is primarily from two areas, checking accounts and capital. We have about $25 million of that where we can do whatever we want because we don't have... If you remember, the savings and loans went bankrupt when they made a bunch of 8% mortgages with 5% money, and then rates went to 12, 14%. Well, they were paying 12, 14% on their CDs and getting 8% on the loans. So one of the things we've done in the last 25 years is to be very, very careful with that. But we have a pool of about $25 million where the investment is discretionary. We have $17.8 million of that in real estate, in-house real estate loans. As I mentioned, people fall into one of two groups, and we literally give them a choice. If they have, invariably they will choose the 5% because it's a couple hundred bucks a month in just interest. If they qualify for it, they'll want the secondary market loan. That's just too much money to leave on the table. They know that one of the downsides is that loan's going to be sold, it's going to be serviced in another place, and it's going to be more difficult to communicate to the people if they have a problem. If they stay in-house, they can come in and talk to the bank anytime they choose. Our bank is 6.5 years old. The previous bank I started in Newport, we were there about 5 years. So far, we have not had a foreclosure. We're coming up, I think, on our first one. We have about a $750,000 residence where the people are so overwhelmed with other debts that they're probably going to give up. That'll be our first one. And just as you had an attorney talk to you about foreclosure, what happens? I had one of those conversations with our bank attorney last week. What happens now? Do we do a judicial or... what's the other option? Non-judicial. But it's something we don't like to do. But anyhow, if it goes, the people have to have their act together if they want the 5% secondary market. Occasionally, they do come in if something gets behind. There's been a couple of occasions where we have financed them out of it, put them in-house. Primarily, our in-house loans fall under a number of... They're short-term. Somebody's going to sell a house, so they're buying something locally. We make them the loan for a couple of years while they sell their house. There could be something wrong with the house, so no foundation, for example, and it's not eligible for the secondary market. We finance those, give them the funds, a construction project for them to put the foundation on it, and then we refinance them into the secondary market if they so choose. They may have credit problems. Now, a lot of the people we deal with, we've known for 20 and 25 years, and this is the fourth bank I've been at in Newport, and we literally have people follow us around because we've learned about them and their families, and we're there for them. But anyhow, that's the two areas we do there. I don't know if there's anything else you want to have or questions out of that. We try not to have foreclosures. When we have loans that are in defaults, and this is any commercial, whatever, we basically kind of surround it and attack it and try and figure out a solution. We will ask the people what they want to do, what options they have, what type of programs they want. We'll special construct programs. Our community, for example, if you're a crab fisherman, your big income month is January and February. And after that, your year is basically done if that's all you do. So if we have payments, they're front-loaded right in there. We have a pretty good-sized fleet in Alaska. They're up there right now. Cod fishing, I believe, at the moment. And we design the cash flows right around those industries. We do that specially for individual one loan after another. If somebody gets in trouble, the one situation we're really watch is when somebody gives up. Occasionally things are so tough out there that you can tell they've just been beaten down. And when that happens, some member of the family has to step in, or they will give the house back. They will give up. As long as they're out there pitching, we don't want their house back. And so far we've been pretty clever, and there are forces out there conspiring against us, regulators and accountants, but we try and figure out ways to meet within the various rules that we can figure out a way for these people to work and stay in their homes, and it's good business for us.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask, I'll ask Pam first, a little bit about, you have in your written testimony that you've had an increase in requests for modifications. Can you talk a little bit about that process, modification process? Thank you.
Sure. Anecdotally from the members that I talk to, they have either current members or individuals who have loans at other places that have come to the credit union, certainly to adjust their loan, whether they want to go into now a 30-year fix. And unfortunately, I don't have great statistics for you, but I can tell you that we get those requests every day. We're working on them. We're trying to respond as much as we can to the loan modifications. I can tell you that we can't help individuals all the time, but I know that our members are out there trying to do as much as they can.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator George and then Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the banking side, one of the things I'm hearing from a lot of businesses is that that they're having a tough time accessing loans from institutions, and then also from folks who are in at least some of the development industries who bought land that are in development zones, and now those values have gone down considerably. How much flexibility do you have to work with those types of business people who, let's say, for instance, bought in a development zone at a higher price, and now the value's low, they're losing money someplace else, to actually refinance that or write down that loan and refinance at a lower level? Can you do that? And then the second question is, how are you dealing with businesses who need credit lines, but as your capital is shrinking, you continue to extend those credit lines to folks?
Okay.
So it's kind of two parts.
I'll take the last question first, as that's the one that's easier to answer. I mentioned before about two-thirds of our deposits were placed out in loan. That makes us one of the lowest of Linda's 40 banks in the state of Oregon. A few years ago, a lot of banks kind of determined that they could make more loans and make more profitability. And in this current environment, that's come back to bite us a little bit. So basically, we ended up with a lot of capacity, and we are actively looking for good loans. When some customer from another bank comes over, we look at that as an opportunity to kind of bring them into our fold, and if it's a good loan, we make it, and that's all the commercials. I hope to goodness that these things don't get so dire that all these things go bad, but we basically have been making loans right along. The construction part of it here, there's no real good answer for that. If you've got somebody with a $10 million subdivision, and you know, it started out as a piece of farmland worth a fraction of that, and then they put in the streets and the water and whatever else, and the entrepreneurial part of it kind of ramps that up. You know, there may be $4 or $5 million worth of expenses, but in the market out there, the lots are worth $200,000 each, and you can mathematically calculate that and come up to your $10 million. All of that is based on the proposition that they're worth $200,000 each. So when that goes away, and that's what you're seeing around the state here, is those subdivisions, all of a sudden there's a surplus and the values aren't there and people aren't buying them, and the people who did buy them can't afford to pay them. And there's not a lot we can do, because the accounting for that, if it's worth $7 or $8 million, we have to write it down to $2 or $3 million. Invariably, these people don't have huge amounts of cash because they're developers. They live on borrowed money. So that is, and that's what's happening around the area. If there's banks in trouble, it's probably in that type of construction lending. It's a very, very tough situation.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Oh, let me follow up if I could.
Sure.
So in those such situations, I mean, in essence, you have a real problem, because you're going to have, as those markets start to deflate, you're going to put more pressure on the residential folks, because if you have lots that were worth $200,000, now they're worth $50,000, that could start to deflate the entire appraisal process of what lots are worth, what homes are worth, and those different things. So the question is that when you get a loan like that, and it's in the ownership of somebody who is in the business, do you have the regulatory flexibility to actually write that loan down to them and, renegotiate the principal?
Are you talking about a house that's...
I'm just kind of talking about like the subdivision you just gave the example of. So they bought a piece of property that's worth $10 million, and you gave them a loan at $10 million at the time, and now that loan, that property may only appraise out at maybe $5 million, and they obviously can't pay any payments based off of $10 million. Do you have the flexibility to come in and write that loan down and renegotiate with the owner, or do you typically have to take that property back and then put it back on the market?
It depends on the loan to value of the loan that was made.
Yeah.
Senator George, Fred probably can weigh in better, but I can tell you, to that second question you just asked, my understanding from some examples I've heard is that it really just depends on what the original loan was. I have a bank that's a very conservative bank in the state that's faring very well during this challenging time, but they have a loan that they're dealing with that they're going to have to take the property back on, but it was a development loan, much like you're speaking of. It was in Central Oregon, and originally when the loan was made, it was valued at something, and don't quote me on these numbers, but it was something around $20 million for this piece of property, and then it was revalued at $10 million. They had only made a 50% loan on this property, and it was actually a participation loan with another bank, so they shared the loan, but so essentially the loan on the property was $10 million, but now it was revalued just recently at something around $7.5 million, and at some point the bank has a responsibility to move that non-performing asset off its books. It can't just write it down and then make a new loan to the borrower if it has the ability to recapture some of that $2.5 million loss. It's going to have the fiduciary responsibility to do that. Am I correct?
Pretty close.
You can correct it. I also wanted to add, if I may, banks are certainly in the business to make loans, and I get a lot of questions right now about credit crunch or accessibility for business lending. And the fact is that there has been tightening of standards among some banks, but the vast majority of banks that are supervised by the state of Oregon are continuing to make loans, and they are still well capitalized. Those that are in some serious stress right now are certainly those that were more exposed in construction and development lending, which is part of the housing market challenges that we face. So for business lending in general, I think the message I would leave you with is that the state chartered banks that you have the authority to regulate, they're really part of the solution to the current economic crisis we face, because they are well capitalized and they do have money to lend. And that's not always the piece of information that makes the news.
Thank you very much. Senator Burdick, you had a question?
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to kind of validate what Pam said about the credit unions and lending. My credit union is, I get mailings from them regularly. It's very clear that they are quite energetically letting people know that there is money out there to be lent. But it also led, reading your testimony, hearing your testimony, your conservative financial position kind of pays off at times like this. But it kind of made me wonder what the what this whole economic situation has done to the basic resource base of credit unions. Are you seeing lower deposit, people taking more money out of the credit union? Is this going to be a factor going forward?
Chair Bonamici and Senator Burdick, credit unions began in the 30s around the Depression era. They really were at a time when people needed to come together and pull their money together. They began in the United States at an economic crisis. And so we are seeing that people are turning to their local credit union, not-for-profit financial institution, for products and services. Now, with that said, we also were formed around occupation and businesses. So we have, formed around companies. Therefore, our members are losing their jobs. Credit unions report to me that people drive up and turn over their car keys and say, I certainly can't afford to make my payments anymore. And we are certainly feeling the stress of our members losing their jobs. And while I was really actually shocked when I got some of the delinquency and foreclosure information, it was a lot lower than I had anticipated. But I am hearing our credit unions are certainly challenged with some of the auto loans and the other lending products. But I can tell you that membership numbers are on the rise for Oregon credit unions.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I know we need to move on, but I just had a quick question, probably not so much for Fred, because I know you haven't had a lot of experience with residential foreclosure, but for Linda and for Pam, one of the things it seems like that other states have done with mixed success is actually had somebody in a governmental agency reviewing foreclosures and then trying to intervene and reach out, which is something that Oregon has chosen not to do. But I guess what I wanted to hear from both of you is, when you see loan customers who are clearly getting in trouble, and you can sort of imagine the psychology of people who've lost their jobs and just want to pull the covers over their head and hope it will all get better, do you proactively contact your customers and do something to try to get them to work with mm-hmm. you?
I'm happy to take that, Senator Rosenbaum. Banks view, and banks of all sizes, absolutely view foreclosure as the very last resort. I've heard statistics ranging up to $40,000 on average for is the cost to the bank if they have to go through a foreclosure proceeding. It's a last choice for the bank. Unfortunately, despite repeated attempts by banks to reach out to customers, and I actually heard an example today from a banker from U.S. Bank who told me that they actually tried to go to a program where they could have raised the rate because it was an adjustable rate mortgage, and they went in and said, we're not going to raise the rate, and this was when LIBOR was going crazy, and we need you to sign this paper in order for us to do this because it was a change in terms. They didn't get any response, so they started sending people prepaid cell phones saying, use this prepaid cell phone to call us. They eventually got to 80% response, but they were trying to actually help these borrowers avoid a reset of rate that was higher. But there's a real challenge there, and so banks are becoming very, very creative in how they get in touch with customers that are behind. But when it gets to a point that a customer actually wants to reach out to a lender, we think some of the programs that have been initiated on a national level have been very effective. We've looked at some of the programs in other states. Some have been less effective in that they've actually been a disincentive for lenders to continue to do business in those states. But we've looked at some of them. I would say that Hope Now Alliance is an alliance of many of the large national lenders, and they have an 800 hotline. That's been pretty successful. I heard from last month's statistics that 2.2 million foreclosures have been avoided nationally through the Hope Now Alliance, which includes many of our large national banks doing business here in Oregon, and that includes 1 million loans that were actual mortgage modifications. They take about 7,000 calls a day. Other programs, like the Hope for Home Ownership program that many of you have heard about, we haven't felt that that's worked all that well because there's some disincentives for the borrower who's facing devaluation of their property to participate. So we're working with Congress in trying to make that more effective. The FDIC has also recently announced a new national program where they could participate in sharing some of the risk that comes with secondary default on refinance properties. We're looking at working with them to support that program. So I guess what I'd say is that we're doing everything possible, including trying to come up with a solution in how you refinance mortgages that have been securitized. We're doing everything possible to try to help in this situation, and I think there's some very good programs that are out there, but certainly more work to be done in this area.
Thank you very much. I look forward to working with all of you on that issue. And Pam, you have
Just Senator Bonamici and Senator Rosenbaum, I failed to mention the last page of my testimony is from Paul Kirkbride with Unitas Community Credit Union. He runs the mortgage division and also served on the Mortgage Lending Task Force. He actually goes into detail in his testimony. He was able to participate yesterday, but not today. Goes into detail about how they view foreclosure. Our federal regulator, the National Credit Union Administration, which is the equivalent to FDIC, have given us directives that foreclosure is the absolute last option. And he talks about all the options that they kind of consider in helping members. So I just wanted to direct you to that.
Thank you. Any final questions for this panel?
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Postlewaite, for traveling to Salem to testify today. Next, we have Chris Ambrose from the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association and Eric Wiley from Pacific Residential Mortgage. Welcome. Did you flip a coin to see who goes first?
I got the short one on that one.
Does that mean you go first?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, I'm Eric Wiley, principal in Pacific Residential Mortgage, also representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. Not having a lot of specific experience with the foreclosure process, thankfully, I'd like to instead talk about the Oregon mortgage market marketplace as well as mortgage lending in general as it is today, and then take any questions at the end. Today's residential consumer and commercial lending standards have definitely changed and have definitely tightened. The loosening of guidelines from 98 to 2007 has corrected. Non-prime loans are actually gone. Credit markets don't want them, but more to the point, more recently, regulations generally prohibit them. Lenders are largely avoiding any form of perceived risk. The private secondary market for home loans is gone. And this was Wall Street, which represented up to 60% of mortgage-backed financing, 2 years ago. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the primary secondary market, are in government conservatorship. Massive changes there. And the Federal Reserve, with lack of other big money sources and big supply of money, is acting as the acquirer of mortgage-backed securities. We are experiencing a return to mortgage lending fundamentals, however, and these fundamentals are a reliance on the complete scope of the borrower's credit worthiness. That includes their income, their assets, their credit, and a full valuation of the property. Non-owner-occupied financing is largely restricted now, and I felt that was important to mention based upon the fact that we're going to talk about, I understand, some tenant rights as well. The current state of mortgage lenders, large and small, is in many cases grim, actually. Banks are under immense financial pressures. Many have failed. And if you look at 2008, Countrywide, the biggest home lender in the nation heading into the first 2 weeks of 2008, failed and was acquired by the Bank of America. Additionally, you've got IndyMac, a top 10 mortgage lender that failed in 2008. Washington Mutual, a top 10 bank and the biggest bank failure ever, failed in 2008 due to mortgage lending. Wachovia, not to be outdone, 2 weeks later, essentially failed and was assumed by Wells Fargo. National City, another top 10 bank in the United States, failed last year. The big five Wall Street banks failed, and that includes Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, and the rest. AIG, a trillion-dollar insurance company, failed. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in conservatorship. Essentially, they were bankrupt. The list goes on with Citigroup and now Bank of America also facing financial straits. To lend or not lend is the question for banks today. And I think we heard a little bit of perspective with respect to retaining cash, building stability in a financial institution, at the same time looking at how to lend and how to lend properly. It's a balancing act today. Capitol Hill is asking for lending. The public at large is asking for lending. TARP was created to foster reinvestment and lending into communities. However, at the same time, the OCC and other regulators are looking at wanting to maintain the stability of banks and have banks bolster their balance sheets in an effort to strengthen the banking community, those that remain. Quarterly losses, lenders are actually concerned at this point that posting quarterly losses could in fact jeopardize the firm as an ongoing concern based upon stock price, based upon market perception. What is happening here in Oregon? Home values, as across the nation, are falling off of highs established a few years back. High loan-to-value loans, whether they were made to high credit standards or not, are in the same boat when considering home depreciation factors. And speculative buying is a thing of the past, whether on one's own home or as an investment property purchase. Speculative lending is also gone. The inventory of unsold homes is up, but buyers are sitting on the sidelines as the media tells them we aren't at the bottom yet. However, given today's low interest rates, I'm hoping that spring and summer we'll see a renewed interest in purchase activity as home prices have fallen and as affordability with low interest rates is up. Unemployment is up, and big firms such as Intel are introducing layoffs. For the employed, variable income is down for many Oregonians. It's a reality that variable income, self-employed income, commissioned income, bonused income, is down generally across the board. Jobs associated with the housing boom have been eliminated. Employers in general are having to tighten their belts. Personal wealth has generally taken a hit from real estate and a retirement and savings perspective. Now, what happens to homeowners and landlords in trouble? This is general, but it reinforces some of the market conditions people face. They might not qualify for a refinance of the existing home, and that's, of course, because lending standards have tightened. If they are having financial challenges, their options may be limited. They may not have much equity. Maybe they have negative equity requiring a short sale that can take time to negotiate. Today's housing inventory is up, and therefore average listing times and the time it takes to sell the property may not allow for a heightened interest in moving a property quickly. Loan products that might have helped homeowners in need a few years ago are removed from the marketplace, and whether due to market forces or through enhanced regulation. Loans are being modified and short sales are being approved, but this takes time. The sheer volume of requests in both categories, some upon reasonable circumstances, many that are not, are a challenge to mull through, given that each and every circumstance is entirely unique and deserves its own individual attention. Loss of some or all of a household's income may mean that any ability to repay, regardless of what loan product or what loan they have presently, even a modification thereof, that may not be a viable option if they have no household income or it's been so greatly reduced. Sadly, but a reality nonetheless, the financial institution servicing the loan might be concerned that the acceptance of loan-related write-downs and actual losses could push them to the insolvency. Even today, about half of homeowners still, after all of this discussion and all the efforts here in this state and nationally, still don't reach out to their home loan servicer when they're in trouble of delinquency. To conclude, lending standards have tightened and regulatory oversight has increased dramatically. This is a good thing overall when considering the long term. It is a difficult thing for those caught in a bind today. Loose financing is gone. However, the legitimately self-employed are now suffering from a lack of credit availability. And this is true. Many of today's standards, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and government-backed mortgages do not really take into account the needs of the self-employed. And I'm not talking pie-in-the-sky self-employed figures, but rather realistic self-employed figures. These folks represent a large portion of this state's population and working class. They are suffering from lack of availability of financing today. Flexible financing options aimed at helping a homeowner in trouble are removed from the marketplace. In the case of high loan-to-value lending, this is actually a good thing. In the case of lower loan-to-value lending, this has a negative impact to consumers and leaves them with limited options in the case of a financial hardship.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ambrose, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Chris Ambrose of Ambrose Law Group and also here on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. The Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association is the Oregon affiliate of the National Mortgage Bankers Association, which comprises approximately 85% or so of the first mortgage loans that are done in this country. I'm going to focus on basically the foreclosure aspects and the response of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders members in the foreclosure process in general. But just following up on a couple earlier items, first and foremost, we believe that it is critical that this committee and this legislature not do anything that's inconsistent to the best of its ability with what's happening at the federal level. As a participant on the Mortgage Lending Work Group, Governor's Task Force, with a number of other individuals in this room, it's been a general concern and a general theme throughout that there has been a concern about putting in place some legislation that is going to inevitably be in conflict with what may be happening at the federal level, in which case there's either going to require a modification somewhere down the line, or it is going to be inconsistent with the myriad of regulations that the Oregon lenders are having to deal with right now. Ms. Navarro testified earlier, there are approximately 50 pieces of legislation that are pending at the federal level. Perhaps that was Ms. Levitt. I apologize. Bottom line is that there is a ton of legislation out there that's being worked on that may affect and will affect the lenders in Oregon, given that the bulk of them, the bulk of the first position residential mortgages are comprised of loans from federally regulated lenders. Additionally, as I believe it was Fred Cosgrove of the Coast Bank indicated, to quote, surround it, attack it, and try to find a solution. I can't say it any better what the members of Oregon Mortgage Lenders are generally trying to do with the loans, the problem loans that they have once it reaches the delinquency stage. Surround it, attack it, and try and find a solution is what every one of them does, because as Ms. Navarro testified, it is incredibly expensive to foreclose. No lender, this has been repeated many times, no lender wants to take the property back. Statistically, Oregon still is at the lower end of the problem states, if you will, which is not to suggest there aren't problems out there. There certainly are. From the most recent data from the Mortgage Bankers Association, which unfortunately goes back to Q3 2008, although the indication is that it's going to be fairly consistent with the end of with Q4 2008, had Oregon at number six for serious delinquencies. Serious delinquencies defined as that percentage of loans that are 90 plus days delinquent. And that number was at 2.3% of the loans. Again, higher than anybody would like, but is still, relatively speaking, at the lower end of the spectrum. Why is the 90 days delinquency number important? That, by and large, is the date by which a lender will determine whether or not to commence the foreclosure process. Again, there are exceptions across the world. There are certainly some lenders that will commence a foreclosure immediately upon the first default. By and large, given that they don't want the property back, by and large that it is an expensive process, they'll start that process 90 days plus of into the delinquency process. The other statistics I'd like to throw out is the foreclosure start rates. That is the percentage of loans that enter the foreclosure process during a given time period. Oregon was number 11 on that at 0.61%. Statistically speaking, the bulk of the foreclosures that are skewing the numbers nationally are still Florida, Arizona, California, Nevada. You take those numbers out, and statistically speaking, the numbers across the board, including for Oregon, are dramatically different than what is portrayed in the media. Again, I don't want to leave here with anybody getting the impression that there aren't problems that that Oregon has in dealing with these issues, but by and large, what is being perceived in the media is far outweighing what is actually happening in the state of Oregon at this point in time. There also are a number of pieces of legislation that are out there in other states. I've had the opportunity to review many of them, and I really am happy to report that the bulk of the ones that I've been reading about are really bringing up to speed what Oregon already has in place. At the last legislative session, there were a number of concerns about making sure, first and foremost, that the borrowers knew what was going on. One of the lenders' complaints was that the borrowers either did not know or failed to come forward with respect to what their issues were and their delinquency status. And one of the goals of the last legislative session was to continue the education process, to increase the counseling available, and to increase the notices to make sure that they understand, yes, as soon as you get that notice of default or that trustee's notice, that you know exactly what's going on and that you can come forward. Because, again, the lenders want the borrowers to come forward, and anything that can be done to encourage the borrower education and their willingness to come forward and speak with the lenders and try and work out some kind of loan modification or refinance or other steps that might be available is critical. By and large, it's our opinion that the foreclosure laws in the state of Oregon are working, especially with the modifications that were done the last time. You have loans that are generally 90-plus delinquent, days-plus delinquent. There's a minimum of 120 days notice before the foreclosure sale can actually happen. The occupants are provided notice at minimum 120 days beforehand, as well as 30 days prior to the foreclosure sale. The notices are provided in a manner that are intended to the best of the lenders and the trustees' ability to notify both the occupants and the borrowers of exactly what is going on so that they can come forward. I understand that there have been a couple other pieces of legislation, SB 239, I believe it is, and 241, that address some of the issues. The Oregon mortgage lenders' sole concern at this point in time would appear to be a provision that would add on to the time in which an occupant has to leave the premises. It is simply the position that we believe that will increase the cost of the foreclosure. It also will preclude buyers from coming forward at a foreclosure sale, which first and foremost is going to help both the borrower and the lender when all is said and done. If we believe that there was a failure of a tenant to know of the circumstances regarding the nature of the foreclosure and what is likely to happen, then certainly we'd be willing to address that situation. We simply don't believe that by and large is what's going on out there. In conclusion, a lot of what we're seeing right now is simply gamesmanship. It's got nothing to do with a borrower not having the ability to come forward with the lender and work out a resolution. It has everything to do with trying to extend the process as much as possible, not always in the sincere attempt to reach an amicable resolution. In conclusion, to the extent necessary, we believe that we should continue to look towards educating borrowers, having counseling for borrowers to the ability, to the extent available. Right now, the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Division of Finance, and numerous consumer advocates are working towards that end, and we believe are doing a wonderful job in taking care of any borrowers that are really interested in resolution. One issue that has come up is the last time we had to deal with foreclosure consultants, and by and large, we're seeing a lot now of out-of-state loan modification companies. To what extent it's becoming a problem, I honestly can't really say at this point in time, other than it's something that is certainly on the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, the association's radar. Thank you for your
time. Thank you very much, and thank you for all your work on 3630 and for bringing the out-of-state loan modification programs to our attention. Are there any questions? I'd like to keep questions brief if we could so we can move on to the next set. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Angela Martin from Our Oregon and Matt Wallace from Osberg. Welcome. Who's going first? Have you decided? Angela.
I won the straw. Thank you. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify before you today on this very important issue. My name is Angela Martin. I am here representing Our Oregon, a statewide nonprofit working on tax and economic fairness. It goes without saying that subprime lending and the emergence of new and creative financing has been a topic of much discussion before this body. I had the opportunity to participate over the spring and the summer in the governor's mortgage lending work group, where even more conversation and discussion took place. Opponents of state regulation have held fast to the notion that non-traditional loan products and practices within the subprime market, which were of great concern to consumer advocates, were a boon to home ownership. It's now clear that the much-touted benefits of relaxed underwriting standards and exotic financing were temporary at best. There's no one in this room who hasn't felt the impact of the subprime housing downfall and the resulting economic crisis. All predictions are that the pace of foreclosures will continue well into 2009 and 2010. In particular, we're seeing sharp increases in foreclosures in what are often referred to as Alt-A loans. Alt-A is a grade of loan. It's not a loan product. Some of the common features of Alt-A loans are payment option loans, which negatively amortize. They grow over time. Or interest-only loans. These loans have a longer fuse before the homeowner realizes a much higher monthly payment, and these are the types of loans that we see continuing to fuel the foreclosure crisis ahead. A January 2009 report by Center for Responsible Lending provides some really useful information for us on what we can expect and what we have seen already. Nationally speaking, we know that over 1.5 million homes have already been lost through subprime foreclosure, and another 2 million families with subprime loans are currently delinquent or in serious danger of losing their home in the near future. Higher unemployment, declining home prices, combined with fewer refinance or home sale options, and the increasing subprime delinquencies, again, mean that home losses and continued strains on the economy. Current efforts to stop foreclosures through voluntary loan modifications are simply not keeping pace with the troubles that we're seeing in our market. Offer you a couple of statistics. State Foreclosure Prevention Work Group, this is a coalition of state banking regulators and attorneys generals, released a report last month that 8 out of 10 seriously delinquent homeowners are not involved in any loss mitigation. Another statistic, Credit Suisse report issued last month, concluded that while voluntary modification efforts represent an aggressive effort from both government and many in the private industry sector, this Credit Suisse report concludes that there are many flaws with these voluntary programs, and they won't be sufficient to stem the rising tide of foreclosures. We heard mention of the Hope Now program, and I agree with the statistics. 2.7 million people, homeowners, have been helped through October 2008. However, it is unclear whether that assistance is actually providing long-term relief. We know that less than 20% of that 2.7 million homeowners assisted, less than 20% of those modifications resulted in lower monthly payments. One final statistic to mention to you is that also last month, Office of Comptroller and Currency report, looking at loan modifications that were completed through the first quarter of 2008, found that 50% of those loan modifications resulted in a redefault within the first 6 months. So we're seeing that there are a lot of aggressive efforts without positive long-term results. And that's one of the things that we'd like to raise with you today. Before I briefly touch on the issue of loan modifications, a couple of other statistics I think are important to mention. We heard a lot about the number of folks currently in foreclosure, currently in delinquency. Those are important quarterly statistics to look at. There's another way that we can be looking at these numbers. Quarterly reports allow us a point-in-time snapshot of how all mortgages are performing. And it can be broken down through subprime mortgages. How are all of those subprime mortgages performing? These include loans that were issued in 1990. 1980. So it doesn't really give us an idea of how are the loans that were issued during the height of the subprime frenzy, how are those loans performing? And for a couple of those statistics, you'll see in my testimony, 26% of subprime loans originated during the second half of 2005 are currently delinquent or have ended in foreclosure. Subprime loans originated during the first half of 2005, the comparable figure of how many are in foreclosure or are seriously delinquent, that number reaches 42%. So we can see that for the class of folks who entered into the housing market or refinanced during the subprime frenzy are the ones that are facing the gravest danger. As the stakeholders on the national level continue their efforts to negotiate a solution to stem this growing tide of foreclosures, I would argue that states can and must use the full extent of their legal authority to provide more immediate relief. Reducing foreclosures without a taxpayer-financed bailout of homeowners is achievable at the state level. We'll be hearing testimony from other advocates that will go into greater detail about what these options are, so I'll leave my comments to that concept right there. One other piece I want to flag, and you can read more about it in my testimony, is that I would also urge members of this committee to consider the impact of foreclosures on tenants. We see that a significant number of families facing eviction are renters, truly innocent bystanders in the foreclosure process, and we believe there are steps that can be taken to make sure that they are held harmless throughout the foreclosure process. With that, I'll end my testimony, and thank you again for the opportunity to participate.
Thank you so much. Mr. Wallace.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity also to speak before you today on this important issue. For the record, again, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm a consumer advocate for OSPIRG, or the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a statewide, citizens-based public interest advocacy organization. You have my written testimony there, which is a little bit broader in scope in terms of where we view sort of trends in foreclosures and what we view some of the most significant parts of the problem to be, as well as a couple of opportunities and potential solutions. But I want to focus as my spoken comments today on really how the current wave of foreclosures that we're experiencing here in Oregon are harming, first and foremost, families who are losing their homes, but also, and just as importantly, other Oregon families and other consumers who are feeling the effects of the foreclosure crisis and the mortgage meltdown through the continuing economic recession, the wave of foreclosures, which continues to be a root cause, as well as more direct effects on consumer spending and just homeowner equity when you see foreclosures continue to increase here in the state. So by now, the essential story of how lax regulation of mortgage lending combined with new and dangerous investment vehicles from Wall Street helped fuel a housing bubble and, of course, the nationwide wave of bad loans that became one of the biggest causes of our current recession is fairly well known, but there are a couple of things worth touching on. Our view is, frankly, there is a lot of blame to go around for the mortgage meltdown, from borrowers who simply bit off more than they could chew to unscrupulous loan originators who took advantage of sort of an informational gap that often exists, especially between financial professionals and borrowers who are often in the subprime markets. To investment firms who created and pushed what turned out to be very dangerous investment vehicles and ended up slicing and dicing these mortgages and selling risk so far down the line that of course when the shoe finally dropped, again, we see the effects of that crisis all across the economy. And of course, you know, federal regulators who took a pass and allowed those things to happen, and rating agencies who in many cases called all of these investments AAA. So, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around for the mortgage meltdown. But there are a couple of things I think everyone can agree on. The problem is getting worse, both in terms of the wave of foreclosures here in Oregon and in terms of the economic impacts that we're facing and will continue to face, and that we should do what we can here in Oregon to stabilize the housing market and our economy. So as Angela mentioned, while subprime loans have accounted for the bulk of foreclosures, you know, there's increasing evidence that what were once thought of as sort of the less risky Alt-A loans, these are between sort of the prime A paper market and the subprime market, are now the next wave of foreclosures to crash. And for example, Fitch Ratings recently revised its previous assumptions about this sort of Alt-A market. And again, these are Alt-A markets are not a loan product in and of themselves, but these are a class of loans that more often contain what would have turned out to be pretty dangerous loan products. One of those features, again, is negative amortization, where the principal of the loan actually rises because the monthly payment is lower even than the interest, to payment option loans, which allow borrowers to pay only the interest for a period of time. The key fact about most of these loans, at least the ones that are adjustable rate mortgages, is that the payment shock for these loans is extremely severe. You have principals that continue to rise or principals that maintain the same. That only can go on for so long before essentially, a trigger is hit and all of a sudden borrowers are looking at a huge, huge increase in monthly payments. That's why we're seeing more of these loans start to fail, and why we consider that area to be a pretty big risk for the economy here. You can see the statistic in the written testimony, but, 60-plus day delinquencies for loans rated by Fitch increased from, 8 to 14.65% in October last year, and that's just an example. Loans from previous years and previous sort of vintages, as they call them, have increased dramatically as well in terms of delinquency. In Oregon, we've seen these types of loans be pretty popular, and in fact, overall, there are about 50,000 adjustable rate subprime and Alt-A mortgages that will experience that initial reset, and that's from between about August of 2008 and the end of 2009. So suffice it to say, we haven't seen the end of the wider economic fallout from the mortgage meltdown, and if we continue to see some of the investment vehicles that so many loans are bundled into to be sort of downgraded, we can expect the financial institutions, big and small, who invested in this market to continue to take hits as well, which is of course bad news for everybody. So that's sort of the wider story. Pretty complicated stuff in terms of how investments and foreclosures have. Foreclosures in this case have led to a recession. Of course, recessions always, cause foreclosures. In this case, we see sort of a vicious cycle where foreclosures have caused a recession, causing more foreclosures, and we can see the impacts continue to sort of snowball. But there are other sort of ways, there are other ways where the effects of a foreclosure wave here in Oregon just has pretty direct effects, not only, again, on the people who are facing the loss of their home, but also their neighbors. And in fact, we know that every foreclosure decreases the value of surrounding homes significantly by more than $5,000 here in Oregon, for a combined total, essentially, of about $2.5 billion in expected decreased home value, and that's for foreclosure projections for subprime and Alt-A loans from about August of 2008, again, through 2009. And in a housing market that's already suffering, that's indeed bad news. Average home prices, of course, have already tumbled about 16% from their peak in 2007. That loss of homeowner equity is very important. Homeowner equity is the biggest source of savings for many Oregon families and many Oregon consumers. When you see hits to that, you of course see decreases in consumer spending overall, which is also of concern. So I also will limit my comments mostly to that. I do want to say I think again there are options and opportunities for the state to help stem this crisis, stop the bleeding, both for families facing foreclosure and for the economy at large. And so we definitely support the proposal of encouraging mediation, encouraging borrowers and servicers to come to the table and work out modifications for loans that will, in a sustainable way, help ensure people stay in their houses and payments at some level coming in from lenders as well. You can read some of the details there in the written testimony, but I'll leave my comments to that for now.
Thank you so much. I had a question for Angela. Your testimony about tenants says that roughly 40% of families facing eviction are renters, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and if you have any sense of how many of them are month-to-month renters versus tenants' leases.
Chair Bonamici, I appreciate you asking that question for a couple of reasons. First, it provides me the opportunity to correct a statistic from a national report. This is a national statistic.
Okay.
What we learned just recently is that it's unclear how that translates for Oregon. We do know that it's a significant problem in Oregon. You're going to hear more details on that in just a moment.
Thank you so much. Any other questions for this panel? Anybody? Thank you very much. Next we have Phil Goldsmith and Sybil Hebb. Welcome. Have you decided who's going first?
Yes, I'm going first.
All right. We'll have you go ahead and get started. If you'll state your name and what brings you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici. I'm Phil Goldsmith, and I was asked to testify by the committee, and I appreciate that opportunity. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland. I represent mortgage borrowers in various ways, not always in litigation. I was a member of the Mortgage Lending Working Group. And I'm going to testify about why I believe that legislative intervention is necessary in the Oregon foreclosure process to the extent it doesn't duplicate what people have already talked about, and to talk some about the form in which I think that should take place. I have some written testimony on constitutional guidelines on state action. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. I don't plan to repeat that. I also have a number of citations to legal and other sources, excuse me, which for the most part I don't plan to repeat either. You've heard that from Mr. Blackledge that in Oregon residential foreclosures happen non-judicially almost exclusively. What that means is that there is no court supervising the process in a judicial foreclosure. Court acts in what, you know, going back to ancient England, is called equity, which means the court has some discretionary powers, which I'll talk more about later. Foreclosures, of course, have always been a losing proposition for homeowners or home losers. But now they're also a losing proposition for industry. Linda Navarro testified about a cost of $40,000 in terms of out-of-pocket costs. With declining property values, a national study in November, covering November of last year, showed that on foreclosure, 45% of the loan value was realized on average. It might be higher in Oregon because obviously property values haven't declined as rapidly. But so you'd think that people would do like the president of Oregon Coast Bank testified, and or industry would do what, and try to avoid foreclosure at all costs, that they would make rational business decisions when it would be cheaper to modify a loan and lose a little bit than to foreclose and lose a lot. But there are structural factors that stand in the way of that. As you have heard some today and undoubtedly know generally from being reading newspapers and getting information otherwise, most loans over the last decades are not originated and held by a financial institution. They are sold into the secondary market, they're securitized, and then they're sliced and diced into little pieces so that, you know, there's somebody who might own the bottom 5 or 10% of the income stream from a pool of loans.
And if it would make sense to everybody else to reduce principal of the loan of a loan by 5%, everybody else who owns a share of it, the person who's got the bottom 5% may veto it because they'd lose everything. Or there are situations where some of the investors have purchased insurance, or it's technically not insurance. It's called credit default swaps, which has resulted in American General becoming now owned by the citizens of the United States, where if the loan fails, they get paid in full what they're owed. And so if there's some of those investors in that position, they don't have a problem with the loan failing because they're going to get paid in full, even if there would be other investors who would prefer to modify the loan. So those structural problems stand in the way of making rational business decisions that would be made if an institution held the loan from beginning to end. Now, from what I heard in testimony yesterday before the House committee, a number of industry people believe that the largest cause of foreclosures is simply loss of income. We have a 9% unemployment rate in Oregon at this point, and listening to OPB coming down today, in some counties it's as high as 15%. People who have entered into perfectly fair, perfectly reasonable fixed-rate mortgages. If somebody in that household loses a job and has no income or has significantly reduced income, they may be unable to pay that loan and are at risk of foreclosure. And then, of course, as we've heard, there are a lot of loans that have more exotic features. Many of my clients tell me when they've entered into ARMs of some kind that they were told by their mortgage broker, when your interest rate adjusts, you'll have to refinance, or just before it adjusts. Well, in the last few years, everybody assumed, both lenders and borrowers, that housing values would continue to increase, that refinancing would continue to be available for people, and that there would be a solution when would otherwise be payment shock. And that's not true now. There's a story that was in this Saturday's New York Times that says that in some parts, let me make sure I say this right, in some markets in the country, as little as 30% of borrowers who seek refinancing are able to get it. And obviously those people who got loans with high loan-to-value ratios, when values drop rather than rise, are not going to have the equity to be able to refinance. So for those economic reasons, and sometimes as a result of deceptive lending practices, many borrowers are at risk of foreclosure. The most dramatic time in the past with comparable problems, in the Great Depression, most of the states in the country enacted foreclosure moratoriums. Borrowers were excused from paying principal. Sometimes they were required to pay the loan interest. That was an appropriate strategy for that time because the biggest problem was significantly declining property values with significant deflation. That's not a long-term solution now because some ARMs interest rates adjust up to 10-12%, and it's the interest payment in itself which makes the loan unaffordable and puts the borrower in risk of foreclosure. So a mortgage foreclosure moratorium would only make sense sort of as a placeholder. That is to say, if you think or hope that there will be a national solution that is adopted sometime this year, and you want to make sure that people who are in that 120-day process now who might be foreclosed out before there's a national solution are protected, a short-term mortgage foreclosure moratorium would be an appropriate strategy. But what states are beginning to look at, and I have a footnote which cites to some state statutes, is using a mediation program. Oftentimes at the beginning, in a non-judicial foreclosure state, before the foreclosure actually starts, except of course for those loans that are in the pipeline when the statute is enacted, the FDIC has been working hard for the last year or two in trying to come up with programs and guidelines for streamlined modification of loans, and those standards could appropriately be used in a mediation program. But obviously, mediation is an attempt to get two parties to agree to something. And one of the issues that will require creative thinking, if you look at that approach, is to make sure that the owners of loans actually engage in that process rather than simply saying, well, we're not going to move from what we have the right under our loan documents to collect, even if you can't afford it and even if we know that ultimately results in foreclosure. I have a couple of ideas that you could consider in trying to create some, give the financial institutions or the owners of the loans incentive to participate in the process meaningfully. You could require foreclosures that follow a failed mediation effort to go through a judicial foreclosure process. In that way, a court could then make a judgment whether enforcing the original loan terms would be equitable or not on an individual circumstance. Or you could have a moratorium of some kind which required borrowers to be subject to the moratorium to pay what, in accordance with the FDIC guidelines, which is essentially 31% of their gross income. So, in conclusion, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this important subject. You have the opportunity, if you so choose, to do significant social good by preventing homeowners who are, as a result of larger economic forces, in danger of losing their homes, to protect them from that fate. Should you decide to draft such legislation, I'd certainly be happy to lend my whatever expertise I have that would be of use to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I especially appreciate your written testimony with footnotes and citations. You must have been on law review when you were in law
school. No, I was not.
Thank you very much. Sybil.
Thank you, members of the committee. Chair Bonamici, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center here today. Very much appreciate your taking the time to consider all of these issues, and I echo the comments made by advocates before me. Really appreciate that you're examining the full scope of issues that could provide opportunity for possible protection. And I want to talk to you today about a particular issue that we haven't spent too much time discussing, which is the impact of foreclosure on tenants who are living in homes whose landlords are going through foreclosure. And that's an issue that we are becoming increasingly aware of. As you know, the Oregon Law Center is a civil legal services provider. It's our mission to provide access to justice for the lowest income Oregonians, and a large number of our clients, as you might suspect, are tenants. We have offices across the state of Oregon, and we're seeing a rising need for assistance, a rising number of calls, requests for help from tenants who are losing their homes because of a foreclosure of the landlord. So for that reason, we've been investigating what types of solutions there might be, and we've been doing some research. I've provided for you a summary by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, which has provided a best practices sort of analysis of the issue, and that's there for you. I also have a copy of a recent article that was published in the Corvallis Gazette Times, I believe just the other day, I think the 25th of January. I apologize that the print is so small. I'm not trying
trying to make you need glasses. I couldn't get it to adjust for me, so I apologize for that. And that's just one illustration of the fact that we're feeling this issue, we're suffering from this issue here at home. Nationally, the numbers are high, as Angela Martin indicated. The National Low Income Housing Coalition has estimated that approximately 40% of homes of families facing foreclosure are tenants. We suspect that that's probably smaller here in Oregon because on the East Coast, a number of the big cities have large apartment complexes with multiple families. We tend to have smaller apartment complexes here and many single-family homes. So we think the number's smaller. We don't have our finger on that pulse particularly yet, but we're looking at it. Let me just take a minute to step back and sort of describe what current law is for tenants who are in foreclosure. So tenants, Oregon law essentially doesn't provide much clarity for tenants, and in fact it actually sort of negates their rights. What the law is that a home going through foreclosure, the foreclosure process essentially wipes out the lease, regardless of whether that's a month-to-month lease or whether it's a year-long lease or a six-month lease, the lease itself is extinguished by the foreclosure. There's a small exception, which is if the lease was entered prior to the mortgage agreement, then that lease would survive. But in Oregon and most places, most leases are entered into after the home was purchased and after the home was financed. And so it's a significant number of leases that are affected by foreclosure. And the lack of clarity and the lack of protection for tenants is a big concern. You know, that's true regardless of whether tenants have paid their rent on time month after month. The lease is extinguished. We would like to look at that and find a way to address that and provide continuity of the lease through the foreclosure so that tenants don't have to lose the stability that they've had in their homes. Another sort of point about the tenants, the issue affecting tenants is that they're even more vulnerable than low-income homeowners in this situation. Tenants generally are lower income than most homeowners. They have fewer alternative resources on which to rely when they're faced with an eviction because of a foreclosure, and so they face a greater risk of homelessness. The threat of homelessness and the impact on tenants is greater in lower-income communities and in minority communities, and there is a concentration of renters there. And so it's a particular concern for those populations. Despite the fact that these are such compelling issues, we've largely not addressed, not considered the impact on tenants when we've been looking at the issue of foreclosure. I hope that this committee and this legislative session will provide us with an opportunity to more fully consider that. Aside from lease survival, there are a number of other details and issues that are worth considering if we're going to take this issue on. During the foreclosure process, there's a great deal of confusion for tenants as to who's responsible for maintaining the property. Is their landlord still the person that they call when the toilet is broken or the roof is leaking, or should they be calling the lender? Who's responsible there? And by the same token, where do they pay their rent? Many times you have lenders demanding the rent. Sometimes it's been assigned to the lender as a term of the original mortgage, but the tenant often doesn't have access to those documents, may not have an idea of how to rely on the representations of the landlord or the lender. So they're confused and there's not a lot of clarity for them. They're not getting a lot of assistance because it's such a new issue. It's new even for our offices and we're trying to figure out what the law is. But many of the housing counseling resources that have been set up to provide assistance to homeowners are unaware of the implications for tenants, and that resource is not really available for tenants. And so clarity around the responsibilities and roles during foreclosure would be a great assistance, and looking at some of our housing counseling assistance and trying to make sure that there are resources available for tenants there is another thing that would be very helpful. I want to talk for a minute about the notice of foreclosure. I believe it was Mr. Ambrose who mentioned the notice that goes to the occupant of the property as a result of House Bill 3630's legislation last session. I think we, as a group, knew enough to know that it would be good to get a notice to the people living in the house, even if that those people weren't the owners of the house, and so we really appreciate that that effort. I think we got it a little wrong. The notice that goes to the occupant of the home is directed to the homeowner. The language in the notice is geared towards the homeowner, directs the person to resources that have education about how to help homeowners. There's really no addressing of tenants there. As well, I think we need to make it clear that the notice should be specifically directed to the person living in the home. Oftentimes, a tenant might get mail that's not addressed to them, may not even open it. And so we need to think a little bit about how practically the intent of that particular provision can be put into place. To speak more about notices, and now I want to move to the eviction process. Once a foreclosure is moving forward, if we look sort of further down the line, when the purchaser wants to get rid of the person living in the home, they can do that through an eviction procedure. Right now, current law allows the notice of eviction to go out 30 days before the date of the sale of the property. That's what current law is, and regardless of whether we're talking about notices going to tenants who have year-long leases or simply to tenants who have month-to-month leases, the fact that the notice can go out before the property has been sold and the fact that that notice can be given by someone other than the landlord is problematic. It creates confusion, number one, because the tenant thinks, well, do I start looking for a new place or wait, but I'm supposed to pay my rent to the landlord according to this lease. And so how do they know what to do? And the ideal solution there is to make sure that the notice doesn't go out until after ownership of the home has been resolved, after the date of the sale. Another sort of point there is that if the notice doesn't go out until after the date of the sale and the ownership of the home has been resolved, we think we may avert some needless moves because we know there is a small but significant number of foreclosures that are avoided at the last minute for whatever one reason or another. And in those situations, then I think the homeowner, as the landlord, would be very happy to have the home continue to be occupied by the tenant who's paying rent. And, of course, the tenant would prefer to stay and not have to move and incur those expenses and the emotional and physical hassle. Another aspect of that is that sometimes the home might be bought, even if the foreclosure goes through, by a person who wants the home to be rented and wants to maintain it as a rentable home. And so making sure that the notice doesn't go out until after the date of the sale addresses both of those issues. It resolves the confusion as to who the landlord or the tenant's supposed to pay attention to, but it also hopefully avoids a certain percentage of moves and potential homelessness as a result. Another sort of follow-up aspect to that is that if the notice to move results in the purchaser having to take the tenant to court, which can happen because a tenant may be so confused and a tenant also may just be desperate. And so sometimes those proceedings may end up in court. If it gets to that point and there is an eviction, there's an additional sort of concern and burden for a tenant because then the tenant, through no fault of his own or her own, is going through this process as a result of foreclosure and now has an FED on his or her record. And that can be an additional barrier to seeking further housing, which will then be necessary as the eviction gets finalized. So there's sort of a scope of protections that can be provided at different stages through the process, and we'd really like to continue talking about all of those things. I would point out that there is a significant advantage in many circumstances to lenders to providing these protections for tenants because in many circumstances it's to the lender's advantage to have the home continue to be occupied. If the home's occupied, it's not as at much risk of vandalism and other crime. Got a tenant living there who wants to maintain it as a place to be with his or her family. And so that can be good for families as well as communities, and we think also for lenders in many circumstances. And I think as a reflection of that, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have recently both decided that they will not be evicting tenants as a result of foreclosure. So we think there's good precedent set for others to follow suit. And I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. You both did an excellent job of outlining these issues and coming up with some excellent ideas as well. So, committee members, do you have any questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Fascinating testimony. I really appreciate it. And any conversations, Sybil, with any of the banks, financial institutions that hold these loans about their willingness to, I mean, is there any resistance to this type of legislation? To me, it seems like it works for both sides on the way you describe it.
Well, to be frank, Senator Bonamici, Chair Bonamici, and Vice Chair George, it's a great question, and no, we haven't really had formal discussions. It's a new issue to us, and so we're just bringing it up. I think that, and I couldn't speak for the banks, of course, I think, you know, I've had informal discussions with a few people, and I think there's some, probably, I would guess, it's probably fairly new to them as well. And I can claim, you know, we haven't raised it until recently. Sort of, I think it took us a while to realize that this was a trend. And it took us a while. I think it also took a while for tenants to start to identify that they could seek help. They were probably going places that weren't directing them in the right, you know, to the right offices. So I think we're a little slow to identify the issue. It's my great hope that we can do something good.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, yeah.
Senator Rosenbaum.
It's unfortunate it's so late that this has been a jam-packed hearing, but I'll just ask maybe two questions. So first, Phil, for you, I just have to say it's the first time I've ever heard a lawyer say the constitutional implications of something are self-explanatory. I always thought that was the hardest class in law school. So I wanted to ask you, though, that the idea of mandatory mediation seems in your testimony to suggest that that might or might not work, but it would probably work better if there were actually some judicial review at the end of it. So could you talk a little more about this mediation in a circumstance where, you know, one party isn't very interested in modifying the terms of an agreement? How does that actually do any good? Well, that was, and actually my colleague just said, would it be binding, mediation binding in some way?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Girard. Well, mediation by definition is a consensual process. So it would only be binding if there was an agreement reached. The process could be established so that sometimes mediation is confidential and nobody knows how it failed, if it failed. But it could be established that if there was not a successful mediation, that result could be brought in evidence if there was a judicial proceeding that followed. If there was a judicial proceeding, the court would have the powers that it has as a court in equity to determine whether to enforce the mortgage trustee by its terms or whether it should allow for some different result. And there's a footnote that I have to a case from the Depression where the Oregon Supreme Court upheld a trial court that didn't enforce a foreclosure sale given the economic conditions of those times. But so the court would make some set of decisions. It wouldn't be a review of what happened in the mediation, although it seems like if a party was intransigent in the mediation, that maybe that would be a factor the court would want to take into consideration. I realize I forgot to say one thing.
Please, go ahead. We have
which I added to my notes. Thank you, Chair Bonamici. There was discussion earlier about the concerns about an unlevel playing field and the impacts of federal preemption. I don't believe in this context that's a concern. Every lender or owner of a loan, whether it be a federally chartered institution, a state chartered institution, an unchartered private person, goes through the same state foreclosure process. In contrast with what I said about the federal constitutional issues, the federal preemption issues are generally
more complicated than anybody imagines until some set of creative lawyers thinks about them, so there's no absolute guarantee of that. But nobody has ever argued that a federally chartered institution has, by virtue of federal preemption, can foreclose in some way different than using Oregon state law.
Appreciate that clarification.
Thank you.
And did you have another point to make?
Thank you, Chair Bonamici. I appreciate it. I just wanted to make sure to go back to Senator George's question. I was just remembering a previous conversation, and I do think that, just to make sure I'm giving an accurate reflection, I think some of the concerns that have been raised informally, and I don't think well considered, or not necessarily thoroughly considered, I guess, just that I think the extension of the time period and requiring that the notice not go out until the foreclosure sale is complete, I think may cause some hesitation for some around delay of that process. And then the other concern that I think may have generally been expressed is just the sort of concern about creditors or banks stepping in that role of landlord, and what's the I think that that's been resolved successfully in other states that have addressed this issue, and I think of course Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae have provided some good examples. So I just wanted to be I'm sure there may be other details that many other people would add, but
thank you so much. I wanted to add just a point to put on the record. When I did a little bit of research on the tenants and foreclosure issue, I did run across an article that talked about in other states, but it's something to look for here, a situation where the tenant was paying the rent to the landlord, and the landlord wasn't paying the mortgage but was doing, for example, things like going on a cruise or just neglecting to pay completely the mortgage. So I want to make sure that we have an eye on that issue if it starts, if we start to see that here, that sort of intentional non-payment for personal reasons, I think would cause great concern among all the parties. So thank you again. Both of you have been participating in the mortgage lending work group, as well as almost everyone, if not everyone, who was here today. And thank you so much for your continued participation and offer to help work on these very challenging issues. So I'm going to close the informational meeting. And committee, we have on Thursday our first bills in this committee. They are three bills that are from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we'll be hearing those bills on Thursday. So I look forward to that. And if there's no more business, I will adjourn the committee for today. Thank you.
I was going to tell you that there's lots of conflict.